Welcome back to the London Futurist podcast. If you enjoy the show, please consider leaving a five-star review on your podcast platform. It helps others to find us. And feel free also to send us questions and suggestions. Also, we're looking for sponsors to fund a marketing initiative to help us reach a wider audience. The future is rushing towards us, and the better informed we all are, the better it will be. Our guest today is Aidan McCullen. For 10 years, from 1998 to 2008, Aidan was a professional rugby player, delighting crowds in Ireland, England, and France. He made the very natural transition from that into sports commentating, but he also moved into digital media. He started as an intern at Communicore to learn digital media and marketing, and he learned about digital by doing it, living it and building it, as he puts it, by jumping off a cliff and building a plane on the way down. With typical Aidan humility, he says he was just a few Google searches ahead of everyone else. With this grounding, Aidan has made himself a genuine expert on innovation. He's a keynote speaker, an executive coach, a board director, lecturer, and the author of Indisruptible, a mindset of permanent reinvention for individuals, organizations, and life. I know Aidan best as the enthusiastic and generous host of a podcast called The Innovation Show, which offers weekly interviews with leaders in their fields, including writers, academics, inventors, executives, and mavericks. The central message of the podcast, and I think of all of Aidan's work, is that we all need to stay open to new ideas and always keep learning. Aidan, welcome to the London Futurist podcast.
It's great to be with you again, Callum and David. Looking forward to our conversation.
Thanks for joining us today, Aidan.
Thank you, David.
Aidan, a lot of sports stars find their way into public speaking, offering leadership advice and inspirational after-dinner speeches at conferences. And sometimes their stories and advice seem a bit contrived, but you've gone into great depth in your study of innovation. You've interviewed hundreds, if not thousands, of change makers. Are there some lessons, however, from your time as a rugby player that have stuck with you throughout?
I think the biggest lesson I've learned, Callum, is that hard work is essential. You can't bluff it, just like you can't bluff it on a pitch. Your talent might get you there, but it definitely won't sustain you and keep you there. And I think that's the biggest gift. People ask me about the biggest gift rugby gives you. There's two things I experienced. One is that you're forced into this early retirement or early reinvention in your early 30s, because you don't really last much longer than that. You can hang on, but when hanging on, you're more likely to get injured. You're less likely to move on to a different realm afterwards. And then the other thing is that I wasn't that talented as a player, but I was a really hard worker. I worked my way to any achievement that I ever had was due to the hard work I put in. And that's like this gift of discipline. And I kind of see it like this gift that you can point at anything afterwards and then try to excel at that. If you're interested in it, of course, because when you're interested in it, you're willing to put in the hours. And in the realm of innovation, that's certainly what I did. I've put in many, many hours reading the books. As you know, I've read your books, had you on the show, and I do read the book. And I think that's that's a rarity in this world where everybody's so time-strapped. But I do make the time to put in the effort.
That's a lot of reading, because you do a guest a week and usually a book a week. So that's quite a bit of reading. I suppose the other thing, as well as hard work, that you need is luck. Have you got any general suggestions on how to be lucky?
Well, I think you can do your best to manufacture luck. I'll give you an example. So I don't often admit this, but we're between friends, Callum and David. So I'll tell you this one. So at the start of my rugby career, the only reason I actually got into rugby was I was doing French and German, and I was doing French in Trinity College, and I was pretty bad at spoken French, and there was a mature student in my class. So this student was in his 50s, and he had amazing spoken French, and he kept telling me, "Aidan, your written French is great, your spoken French is merde." Okay, so not so great. And he goes, you need to start reading about it. And he goes, look, I'll tell you what, I'll give you something that's the intersection of two worlds for you. You're always in the gym. You're always going training for rugby. This is the French sports paper called L'Équipe, which means team in French. And he gives me that paper. It was folded over on an article. And I didn't touch it for weeks. And then one day, I was getting the bus home from college, and I was bored, and I pulled out this was before tablets, before iPhones, before smartphones, pulled out this crumpled up piece of paper, and I read it, and it's about this club in France that had been devastated by injury and had a what they called was a crisis in the team. So I was like, well, I'm going to France to study French. I'm taking this Erasmus year out. What if I could make that into being a professional rugby player for a year? So I got a guy I knew who was a coach who had played in France to write a letter for me to that club. And it just so happened, and this is unbelievable serendipity, the guy who was the president of that club was also his teammate when he played in France, because he was one of the only Irish players. There was only two at the time that had ever played in France, and he was one of them. And this guy was the president of the club. So I got a contract. So I was on a substantial contract as a 21-year-old. And I did what I was doing anyway, which was working hard, hitting the beach and training hard and slipping the Freudian slip there. And then also hitting the gym. And it was just absolutely amazing, Callum, because I was steeped in French culture in a small town called Dax that had no English speakers. And I was steeped in rugby culture. And because of that experience, I went on to play a decade-long career in rugby that I never, ever would have done, because it wasn't in my consciousness. I thought about it fleetingly, but then it didn't happen until I did this. And where this all came together was I came back, still was going to not play professional rugby. But when I was in college doing my finals, and I went on to do a master's in business, I got a call from the local club Leinster, which is arguably the second best club in Europe at the moment, along with Toulouse, the other team I played for. And they said, we've had an injury in the team and we need somebody who can slot easily into the professional setup. And I was one of those few players at the time, because the game had just turned professional. So they slotted me in there. So if that's not luck, I don't know what is.
That's a great story, and that illustrates a couple of things. One is how working hard will create luck for you, and another one is your tremendous humility. The fact that you played for arguably the two best rugby clubs in Europe, you just sort of slide in there as if it wasn't anything to do with you. It's interesting that you managed to turn Erasmus into a professional rugby career as well. My son has just done his Erasmus year. And he sadly is the last year that any Brit will do Erasmus, That's one of the many casualties of the folly of Brexit, is that there's no more Erasmus for British students. It's a great shame.
It is a pity, real pity.
On the luck issue, and I agree with you, a lot of things do come out of the blue, and sometimes they can transform our lives in completely unexpected ways. I think it also does depend upon what is in our minds, maybe not on our conscious minds, but in our subconscious minds. Are we thinking at some level of some key issue? And then that makes it a little bit more perceptive. When something happens over there, I'm gesturing in the distance, we are more ready to pay attention to it. And if we are not thinking about it, then there will be lots of luck, good luck, which we completely miss. So for my mind, people ask what's the most important skills for learning and to thrive in a world of a great deal of disruptions. We must know at a certain level what we're looking for. And then rather than just being distracted by whatever's entertaining or funny or something else superficial, the thing that matches our underlying desires is more likely to stand out and change our lives.
Beautifully put, David. I have to say, I am so with you on that you have to have a vision. You have to have some type of even fuzzy vision of the future, some type of saliency of what you want to become. And without that, you're not going to spot the little serendipities, the little coincidences that are oftentimes right in front of you. And you won't ever spot them if you don't have a vision. There's a chapter in my book, and I call it The Wasp Trap. And what it's about is wandering aimlessly sans purpose. And I'll very quickly tell you where it came from. We were going on holidays in the newly developed centre parks here in Ireland, which is, for people who don't know, it's like woodland cabins that you drive into and you stay in for the summer. And they just opened. And one of the problems they had was a massive wasp problem. So when we were driving in, we were waiting at the gate, and my children were younger at the time, and a wasp flew into the back of the car. I look back and my son's waving his arms all over the place. And he goes to me, the wasp eventually leaves, and he goes, Dad, why does this always happen this time of year? And he had noted that it happens always towards the end of summer. And I'm a total nerd and curious, and this is where the saliency comes in. And I was like, I wonder why that is. Let's make that part of our project for this holiday. And they were like, oh, here he goes again. So it was brilliant because it gave me this way of thinking about exactly your point, that what happens is when wasps are born, most of them are female. So all the workers are female. Many of the ladies listening to the show will go, well, it's still the case, right? And female wasps have developed this amazing way to cope with the workload that they have. And that's why they have this really thin waist. So they don't actually eat. The only person who eats is the larvae. And the larvae are given crushed up insects by their sisters, their older sisters. The older sisters bring it back to the larvae. The larvae make this sugary spit out of that, and then they lick it. So that's how they actually maintain themselves. And it creates this cycle where they go and get these insects, bring them back, give them to the larvae, get this sugary spit as their reward. Until, at a certain point in the life cycle of the nest, of the hive, the queen stops releasing a pheromone that conducts the life cycle stage of the hive. So what happens at this stage is she stops laying the eggs. She stops, no more larvae. So hence, no more food for the older sisters. So what do? So the way they do this is they actually go looking for the kid with the ice cream cone, the barbecue, the bins, because they'll find sugar in wrappers. They're looking for these simple sugars to sustain themselves. And they, as a result, wander aimlessly, sans purpose. And what my point of that whole story was that you have to have, as an organization, for example, a leader like the queen bee orchestrating where we are in the life cycle. And then equally, if you're an individual just going through life, you have to have a vision. You have to have something to aim towards. Otherwise, you'll just wander aimlessly. And there's nothing worse, I think, than wandering aimlessly. There's a proverb, I think it's a biblical proverb, and it says, without a vision, the people perish. And it's very, very true.
So there's an example from nature, and I gather that in your own work you draw other examples from nature. I'm slightly sympathetic to that, but I also think that technology is putting new challenges in front of us. And although nature can give us some inspiration, I think we need whole new ideas to cope. What's your view?
Absolutely, and where I'm really interested at the moment that corresponds with your world is understanding consciousness and understanding the brain and how you even constructed consciousness. And I suppose it's biology rather than nature, but you find so many aspects in that world that actually kind of go, okay, well, if you're going to construct consciousness, an artificial one, how can you do that by understanding nature, understanding the nature of human consciousness and human brains and logic and the mind, how the mind works, etc. And that's where I'm currently exploring, to your point. And also then at the same point, look into this kind of idea of the centaur, of the half man, half machine, to be able to survive in the world that becomes increasingly technology based. So that's kind of where my head is at the moment, so to speak, David.
How are you using ChatGPT and or any other models like that in your own work at the moment?
So I think what David said there is really interesting, in that you cannot ignore it. And I find it so flabbergasting that you've been talking about this for a long time, as is David, Callum, and people often think it's scaremongering. You look back at some of your talks you've given, even when we first met, which was probably 6-7 years ago, the stuff we were talking about then has come to life. It's come into being. And at the time, people were like kind of going, that's miles away. We don't need to worry about that. Even many, many people in the audience, when they ask questions, say those things to us. And even still, there's this kind of denial of the future is upon us. And it's going to get faster because people don't understand exponential change and the nature of that change. But the way I've done it is the way you do anything. You dabble with it. You dip your toe in the water and trying to figure out what this can do for me. A couple of ways I've brought it to life. One was when I give keynotes. Up until now, I've been paying a brilliant artist to do these amazing graphics for me, like beautiful graphics. I'll send her this like 2-year-old child sketch of a thing and kind of go, here, will you make that into a a beautiful image, and she's just come back with these most magnificent images. Now I don't need to do that anymore. Now I can give that order to some type of generative AI, and it will create text-to-image image for me that's actually beautiful. And the work is back to the discipline skill that I go tweak it, and I add a little bit more. I learn a bit more about the algorithms and how to actually prompt the AI, and then the AI will give me back these images. So that's one thing. And if I bring this to life in my work on a weekly basis, so I use that now to create images for my weekly articles. But then also I write a lot in metaphor, as you just heard with the wasp metaphor. But now I can, and this is where a lot of people don't understand it. The AI is so good at metaphor, which absolutely shocked me. So I can go, I'm thinking of writing this article about this wasp and the whole idea of wandering aimlessly, someone's purpose, whatever. What do you think? And it will come back with a structure for an argument coupled with these different paragraphs. That is absolutely brilliant. And then I can go, find me some reference points or some studies that will actually corroborate what I'm saying here. And it does it in seconds. That means that I don't need any research people anymore. If I was doing so with my podcast, I can now go, I'm interviewing this guy, Aidan McCullen. Give me some interview questions for him, and it will give me back those questions. Now the point is, they're not always accurate at the start, and people then dismiss it. And this is goes back to this whole idea of people will dismiss the idea, the whole idea of Amara's law. I'll dismiss it in the early days and kind of go, oh yeah, that's terrible, and turn away, and then come back and it's absolutely amazing. And go, what the heck just happened? Well, what happened was exponential change coupled with the investment. And we're going through this AI summer at the moment in order for all that investment to happen. And that's the game changer, I think. People are seeing, A, this is profitable. B, it means I can have less people in my organization. As a result, be more profitable. And as a result, my profit per employee goes way up. And that's being correlated with valuations for companies. So when people see the money, the game changes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're a power user. I've tried to get Midjourney and other systems to create images for me, and I never quite get anything good enough. The people have always got six fingers, or I was trying to get a picture of some people in suits with their heads buried in the sand, and they had their heads taken off and put in the sand. That never quite come out right. Maybe I can get a masterclass from you offline.
It's also the tool, Callum. I mean, some of the tools claim to be great, and then they're not. And then some of the ones that you wouldn't even expect. I mean, one of them is Canva. Canva is like, you can sign up for a free account for Canva. Very, very powerful, really, really powerful tool, and can do it quite really, really well. Actually, Canva's been one of the best I've found, and I'm sure there's others. But I just want to tell you one, like, so my son, my son was asking me, he saw the picture, and he goes, what the heck is that, Dad? And what I had was a caveman running away from a hairy mammoth. And he goes, why are you doing that? And I was like going, well, it's actually for a talk I'm doing. I'm trying to articulate what the exponential changes. Now, at this point, I'd lost him. But when I gave him the story, he got it. I said, okay, so exponential means doublings. Okay, so what this means is when I step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in about a meter each, I walk 3 to 5 meters. But 30 exponential steps will bring me to the moon, and the last step between 29 and 30 will bring me from the moon right back to Earth again. And what I'm showing here is the reason why that's difficult is because in the age of when we emerged from the caves, only 200,000 years ago, when I saw a hairy mammoth 30 steps away from me, I knew exactly what that distance was. But the brain doesn't compute exponential change. So then he gets really interested in it. And he goes, Dad, show me how to use this. So he's only 9. So I showed him how to use the Mac to dictate. So it writes out what he wanted to say. Then he takes that, he puts it into ChatGPT. I show him how to do that. Then I show him how to take that and make it into, there's a comic book generator, generative AI as well. And he made a comic book. He brought it into school, and his friend said, I'd buy that comic. So now like a 9-year-old, I'm like kind of going, talk about the old lemonade stand of the old days gone out the window. Here we have lemonade.ai. So amazing world that we're living in. But those initial steps are so simple to take, but so important.
Yeah. And are many of the guests that you're talking to week by week, have the conversations that you're having with them, have they changed because everybody else, or, you know, all of them are using these large language models? Is it changing the nature of the conversation?
I've noticed it's changed it more in keynotes, and certainly when I'm giving a keynote, and certainly when I'm running a workshop, people are listening more. And I think before it was like, well, that was interesting. Now it's like kind of going, they're leaning in a bit more, and the questions are more, they're less general and more specific about, to your point, what can I do with this? What does it mean to my job? What does it mean?
And perhaps a bit better informed as well.
Absolutely. And I think it's your point about they see it now. They see the impact of it. They can see, like, I think about this as a worldwide societal level pension crisis, in that, you know, there's less and less older people to feed, or working people to feed the older people who are on pensions. You know, we talk about this in places like Germany. And as a result, you kind of go, well, what does that mean to the working world? What does that mean to the governments? They don't have this supply of money coming in anymore. And in a similar way, it's like I say to my kids, it's like, and you think I'm scaremongering my kids here, but it's like a game of musical chairs. There's less and less chairs available. In the past, with AI or automation or technology, it created jobs, but I don't see that happen. I just don't see where it can happen when the valuation of companies is based on less people, more revenue per person working in the per employee. So I just don't know where that revenue stream is going to come from.
I guess, you know, we have always created new products and services with automation. I mean, you know, Aidan, I think that the introduction of the advanced AI as we have now isn't going to lead in the short term to technological unemployment. It will create wealth, because that's what making things more efficient does. It creates wealth, and that creates demand, which creates more jobs. I do think we're going to get massive technological unemployment at some point in the future once machines are able to do everything that we can do. They're not yet, and we don't know when they will. But when that does happen, then it's, I think, a fairly obvious logical conclusion that when a machine is able to do everything that we can do for money better, cheaper and faster than us, then there won't be jobs for humans. There'll be lots more jobs. They'll continue to automate things. They'll continue to create new jobs, but the jobs are always done by machines rather than humans. So the job is to figure out, our job is to figure out what that post-jobs economy looks like, so that everybody can have a really good standard of living. But we don't have that, but that's not likely to happen in the next few years. Because every time a machine takes a job that a human's doing, there'll be another job opening up for that human. And by and large, that new job will be more interesting, safer, and more fun. What automation does is partly makes things cheaper, because you can get the same amount of work done with fewer people. But it also makes new services and new products possible. I think one of the things that's going to happen is that all the services which are currently quite expensive now, so lawyering and healthcare and accounting, they just get cheaper and cheaper. So more and more people will be able to use them. And that will then open up all sorts of new opportunities. So I think we're pretty much golden until we get to the point where machines can do everything that we can do, or mostly cheaper, better and faster than us. And then we need to really have a good plan for what comes next.
So Aidan, what career advice are you giving to your 9-year-old? Are you steering your children in particular directions yet, or are you emphasizing general skills rather than particular career options?
Really great question. People are kind of going, oh no, I hope he's not doing that to his poor children. I have a motto with my children, which is, if you ask my kids, genuinely, you ask my kids, what do you want to be when you grow up? Their answer will be happy. So I've kind of, as you mentioned the word subconscious before, I've subconsciously programmed that into them, that do what makes you happy. Because for me, this links back to loads of the things we talked about. If you're doing something that makes you happy, you're going to put in the hours. Sometimes you'll put in the hours anyway, like whether you're getting paid well or not. And then as a result of putting in the hours and then getting paid for it, you'll be like, wow, okay, now I'll put in extra more time, and then I'll become an expert at it, or I'll go to expert level at least. And whether, you know, sometimes it's in the stars, whether you become an expert or recognized as expert or not. But certainly putting in the hours, and you guys know that, is so key. So that's one thing is firstly do something that makes you happy, because you'll put in the time, and then build the skill, if you want to call it a skill, of discipline, because that will help you actually achieve what you need to achieve. So that's the other thing. And then, as I said, I have them playing around with these things. Even Callum, you did a guest lecture when I was in Trinity College a couple of times, and the students absolutely loved Callum. But one of the things we told them, and we were very, very clear, we used to tell them, Callum, about a tool called EssayBot. This was before generative AI is where it is today. And you can literally put into EssayBot give him a headline, the AI a headline, and it will write your essay for you. And then there's a deplagiarize button. Press the deplagiarize button. And they're like, why are you telling this Prof McCullen? And I'm like, because I'll know it was the AI, because there'll be no humanity in your essay at all. But what I want you to do is play with it. I want you to test it out. I want you to test me, see if I can spot it. Today, they're going to be doing that whether I tell them about it or not. And now they have to do almost like counterintelligence, and actually there is tools to be able to spot if the essay was written by AI. That's how good it is now. And this is back to the whole idea of Amara's law. People thought it was terrible, turned away, and now it's great. So that's the other thing, is get them to engage these tools. And then most importantly, I think, is the human skills of communication, collaboration. And the collaboration part is so important, to be able to not just collaborate with other people, but also collaborate with the technology. I think that idea of co-botting, where I'm working with the technology, with the AI, with the robots, whatever it might be. And sorry, the last thing is also coordination. And this is like time control. This is being able to coordinate tools, projects, etc. Because more than likely, many, many people are going to be a gig economy worker, because, to Callum's point there, now I can have an accountant that's an AI. I can have my taxes done by AI. I can have a digital passport, whatever it might be, means that I can actually be more of an independent worker and contributor to society. And actually that will suit many, many people. Many people who don't work well in organizations, who are maybe too curious and don't like being stuck in a box. So I think those are the things that I really emphasize my kids. And then the last thing, and this is to do with you guys, I know you're both coming to Dublin soon to speak in a longevity summit in August. And what this is about is actually looking after your health. And I'm a huge proponent of this, because Callum, you and I spoke about this before when you were a guest on my show, but also I had Aubrey de Grey on the show. And the whole idea is that we're adding on years of longevity to life every year that passes. And as a result, I, for one, do not want to be a prisoner in my own body. I want my body to be functional. I want my body to be, I want to be able to travel. I want to be able to even like put my suitcase into the overhead container in the airplane. And I'm doing the work today, and I'm in my late 40s. I'm doing the work today for when I'm 100. And the way I kind of visualize this is I imagine my future-oriented self looking at me in the mirror and kind of going, hey, man, thank you for doing this. Thank you for doing that. Thank you for not drinking that. Thank you for not eating that. And, oh, man, I owe you big time. So that kind of drives me to invest, like, compound interest in every day for future payoff. And I think that goes right back to sport or business or life.
And I noticed that you didn't recommend any particular skills that they should learn, or any particular lines of work they should go into, or any particular careers. And I think that's very sensible, because what the last few years have shown us is that it's utterly impossible to predict what types of trade, what types of professional career will be automated or disrupted next. We used to think it would be repetitive, manual, blue-collar work that would be disrupted, and now it turns out it might be illustrators and copywriters for low-end magazines or what have you that get completely disrupted first. So, as you say, the important thing is to find something that you love doing and to pursue that, because that's when you'll be good at what you do, and that's when you will put the work in, which is the fundamental driver.
On the subject of collaboration, which you emphasize as one of the things to get better at, how do you decide who to collaborate with? Because you're probably like us, we get emails all the time, please collaborate. How can you figure out which is the right project to put time into and which are the ones to, unfortunately, decline?
Well, I think there's kind of like a Venn diagram, the way I approach of it. The way I think about it is, one is the values alignment. Do the values of the collaborator align with you? Is there an equal give and take in it? Because often, often that's more about what you can give me than what I can give you. And that, I mean, you can smell that it was a mile away. You get them every day, you know, those type of ones. And that's not about the monetary gain, although it's extremely important. And I make no bones about that. People, I go, when you're wealthy, you can make decisions like look after yourself and go to the gym. You can look after your mental health. You can do mindfulness. You can go and support your kids. You can have time to read. And I'm not saying I'm extremely wealthy or anything like that, but actually choosing projects that will give you the best return for your time is so important. I mean, you're not a charity. And I do believe in charity, but you're not a charity. You need to do work that has a proper value of you. And you should value your time. It's the only thing that is non-refundable is your time. So that's one thing, is that the give and take needs to be equal or on par. The values need to be aligned. And then this goes back to what we're saying about the kids and work, is the work needs to be meaningful, because there's nothing worse than doing a meaningful project, a meaningless project, like digging a hole and filling it back in it just to fill time. And it may be funded by some governmental department or body or something like that. And you're just kind of going yawn fest, no meaning in that at all. And I'm not saying if you're stuck for a few bob, don't take those projects. Do. You may need to take some of those projects in the early days to get yourself onto the horse. But when you're established, then you can start to be more discerning about which projects you choose.
Yeah, that's very good advice. I remember an old colleague of mine saying that any job or project you take on should either be extremely lucrative or should give you the chance to do the best work you've ever done. And if it doesn't fill one of those criteria, then you need to think twice about doing it.
Absolutely. And I wanted to just say something you said, Callum, as well, which is like the not recommending a certain type of job. And this goes back to the biology and nature, David, that we talked about earlier on, is I explained to my kids what a stem cell is. And a stem cell is like this cell that just can be programmed to become whatever. So you can have a stem cell as like a liver or heart. And, you know, when you're embryonic, in the embryonic stage, these cells are all just like kind of get programmed to become whatever for the human body. And I kind of go, well, we need this stem cell mindset where we have our values. We know what we stand for. Back to what David said about having that purpose, so you can spot saliency, what's important to you, what opportunities are there. Otherwise, you'll miss things. You miss articles, you miss podcasts, you miss YouTube videos, whatever it might be. You miss somebody saying something on public transport that might be salient to you. When you have those things in a line, and then you're able to just be able to mold yourself to fit that. If you've done the work, and this is where the discipline part comes in, you've done the work, you've built the competency, and then you can just point it at that new opportunity or project.
So we have to be very hardworking stem cells. I like that.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, the interesting thing about the stem cell, there's a whole new science, and this guy Bruce Lipton got hugely criticized for coming up with this science of epigenetics. He created that and brought it to prominence. And the whole idea is that, like, you think about keratin. Keratin can be hair on your head, but it also can be nails, but also can be a cyst, or it can be horns. And he's like, well, what programs it not to become horns on your head and hair instead? And he said, it's because you have this kind of overarching DNA blueprint. And I actually think that's really important for this stem cell mindset. Back to what David said, is you need to have a vision for yourself. You need to have a purpose for yourself, and that will kind of direct what you become as that stem cell in the future.
Could I ask you then what your own sense of meaning is? What are you most of all looking to do?
Yeah, well, I think it goes to what Callum said there about, you know, is it lucrative or is it meaningful? And that latter piece is so important, is that I do think, and I hope, the work I do, like you guys, is helping people make better decisions, is helping, you know, students even before they make the wrong decision, because there's nothing worse than climbing a ladder and realizing it's against the wrong wall, which happens so many people in life, and they're victims to the fur-lined mousetrap or their fur-lined handcuffs, and they're stuck. And then they, you know, they have maybe the big mortgage and the big fancy car, and they feel that they're hostage to that lifestyle. So I try to intercept that if I can, and not put them off it. If that's what they want, great. But just give them another option, another quantum leap to a different being of themselves, perhaps. So that's really important to me. And then that drives also why I write every week, why I do the show. I get so many beautiful emails from people just kind of going, you know what, that really helped me because I felt alone. I felt like as this kind of independent thinker, I was being ostracized within inside my organization. And I go, well, you probably were because you're going against the grain. But realize you're not alone. There's loads of you out there. There's loads of these type of people out there. So that kind of sense of bringing a community of these different thinkers together and supporting them in some way is really important. And then that goes also to my work in driving change in organizations. It's the same thing. It's all got this red thread of education through it. So if I can absorb all that information Callum talked about, like the book a week, try and synthesize it into something more concise in the show and a weekly article and indeed my book, is then hopefully that will help people make better decisions and lead better lives, because ultimately that means a better world for all of us. So that's what drives me.
Sounds great. Well, Aidan, good luck to you. Carry on doing what you're doing. It's fantastic work. And David and I look forward to seeing you in Dublin in August.
I look forward to it, guys.
And we can talk about the future of Dublin and the future of Ireland, as well as the future of work and the future of happiness.
Absolutely. Big challenges ahead.
But we have options, and that's what's really important. Thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.